This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Furtke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of April 17th, here are some top stories. The Valley is home to relatively young cities, which means young buildings. After the housing crisis, many new structures were left abandoned and became blights on the neighborhood. As KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports from our West Valley Bureau, some cities like Peoria are moving past recession-era problems and zapping blights off the map to bring potential development downtown.
Peoria pastor John Rainier unlocks a gate on a city-owned property that used to be a hardware shop in the old part of town.
First thing that people are going to really notice besides the removal of those buildings is these planters start to go in different areas.
Now it holds planters in the process of decoration by local shops. His church's planter has a Wild West theme with a cowboy on one side and a motorcyclist on the other. Rainier says it's one more step towards revitalizing Peoria's old town while maintaining its historic feel.
I think they're going to be just amazed because it's going to show the character. The theming on a lot of them is old and new.
He also shows me vacant lots by his church, where the city bought buildings, tore them down, and then rehabbed the lot. City officials also rolled out a pilot program a year ago, aimed at tearing down or rehabbing blighted buildings. Susan DeLudun is Peoria's deputy city manager and says now, post-recession, is a good time to clean up the neighborhoods.
And in the downturn, we had a lot of programs and livability teams because there were a lot of abandoned properties. And we've gone past that now. Now is the time for reinvestment.
Those unsafe structures not only create hazards, they lower property values and attract crime. Police Deputy Director Jay Davies helped pick a dozen buildings to target with the first-year program.
The buildings that we're talking about, they drain our resources. As vacant properties, we get called to unsecured properties, graffiti, no end of nuisance violations.
Most of these properties are abandoned homes and on small lots. The program is just the first step to get these blights out of the neighborhood, and the city hopes developers or property buyers will see the opportunities of clean, open lots that could lead to development. The program is not unique in the West Valley. Glendale has had a blight and unsafe structure abatement program for almost a decade. Mark Tashkin is Glendale's building inspection supervisor and says they've seen strong results using grant money.
It could be more effective. But funding something like that and having the staffing to address it is an issue, and that's the same with any jurisdiction. But based upon the resources that we have, I think we've been highly effective.
Tashkin says Glendale's abatement program has culled almost 200 unsafe buildings since 2008. Both Glendale and Peoria are relatively young and filled with buildings less than 100 years old. Arizona State University Assistant Professor Megan Ellens is an expert in urban planning. She sees more cities nationwide turning to blight abatement after the housing crisis.
With the Valley being one of the hardest hit areas in the country during the housing crisis, this makes a lot of sense for a community to see these kinds of boarded up situations and then want to take action.
Ellens says now is a great time to take stock of a city's structural landscape.
Thing that is really important to note is the timing of this. This is really forward-looking to start to understand that, yeah, our housing stock is aging. The cities are not static. And so this is an effort to respond to that dynamism in real time.
Back in Old Town Peoria, Pastor Rainier thinks the city has a long way to go in restoring the historical center, but is on the right path.
The visual difference for, say, a business owner wanting to come down here and put a business, having it like this versus the way it was, it's night and day.
City Council has renewed the blight program for at least another year. Almost all of the buildings from the pilot program have already been demolished, though one is under appeal and another is in talks to be saved. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Peoria.
And from the Front Terrace desk, the poorest school in Flagstaff has been the biggest winner when it comes to chess. 46 students have earned the right to go to a national competition in Nashville next month, but some won't make it if the team can't raise enough money. From the Front Terrace desk in Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Chess is a quiet sport. 50 young kids, ages 5 to 11, sit across from each other in a classroom after school. They concentrate on their next moves. Coach Ted Kamada burns enough energy for all of them. He paces up and down the rows, throws his arms up in the air, and spouts strategy.
You've got a rating. Your rating is a number that says this is how good you are. Your job is to make that rating wrong. Be better than that rating.
It's clear Kamada really believes in these kids, and he sees chess as more than just a game.
You decide whether you want to attack queenside, kingside, attack with a knight or a bishop. Find that pin, use the pin. I love chess because it makes me feel powerful, because I'm in control. Those are my pieces. I get to decide what I do with them, how I use them to complete my goal, right? I control that. I mean, there's not too many things in life that you have complete control over. Chess is one of them.
And the children who go to Killip Elementary may not have much control. The school has the highest number of kids from low-income families in Flagstaff. Police are frequently called to the neighborhood for drug and gang activity. A month ago, a young man was shot just down the street from the school during chess practice. James Haney is a coach and a parent of four kids who have played on the chess team.
I see chess for a lot of these students as a place to come where they feel safe. They know that the ones who are around them won't hurt them. They'll know that the coaches are always going to be there.
The chess team started out as a diversion for kids after school 15 years ago. 8 of those years, Killip held the state title. This will be the team's third time to Super Nationals. The Olympics of Chess, as it's sometimes called, takes place every 4 years. 5,000 kids are expected to attend. The last time they went, Killip placed 3rd in the nation. 10-year-old Skylar Boyce remembers.
There was tons of kids.
Boyce smiles, showing his green and blue braces. This year, he wants to place 1st.
It's fun, and you get to learn stuff. Like, stuff that helps you in the real world.
Stuff like focus and problem-solving skills. For 13-year-old Karen Marcato, chess showed her she was capable of much more than she believed.
It just actually helped me push myself. And back then, I would, like, you know, not even pay attention. But now, since coming into chess, actually got me focused to what I was actually doing.
Marcato has taught many of the younger kids to play and is excited to watch them compete in Nashville. Pam Jensen's eyes well up with tears when she thinks about what chess has done for her son.
My son has a lot of symptoms of ADHD, very hyper. He doesn't sit still well. So knowing that, I kept thinking, how's he going to do in chess? In the end, it calmed him. It helped him to stay focused. It helped him to strategize.
Parents like Michelle Padilla say they love the real-life skills their kids are getting from chess.
Coach Kamada here likes to teach them that you want to think about your move before you do it, because it might be give you a consequence of, like, oh, you lost a piece. So in real life, they teach them to slow down and think of what they're going to do before they do it. So that way they can think about a consequence, like, should I do that? It might get me in trouble. They look 2, 3, 4 moves ahead, not just one move.
Padilla gets a little emotional, too, when she thinks about the team walking into a competition.
To travel with these guys and to see us come as this big old blue group, blue shirts.
Must be proud.
I am. I very much am. Proud mother. Yep.
Coach Kamada needs to raise $35,000 to send all 46 kids who have qualified to nationals next month. He's still $4,000 short and has started a GoFundMe page to send the team to Nashville. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now, here's one story from a new series on KJZZ's The Show.
How does that Sesame Street song go? Who are the people in your neighborhood? Or from Jules Dassin, there are 8 million stories in the Naked City. Here's another version of that sentiment. One producer drives a cab around the valley and records some of the backseat confessions she hears. Here's the conversation.
When you're a cab driver, it all starts like this.
Hello.
Regina?
Yeah.
When you're a cab driver with an accent, it goes on like this.
Where are you from? I hear your accent.
Then it takes all different directions.
My cousin lives in St. Petersburg, and we went to see her.
And as soon as you hear something that stands out, you say,
can I record you?
Sure. No, it's okay.
My name is Regina Ravazova. I'm a cab driver, and now you're going to hear what I hear in my car. It is a difficult task to dissect relationships in any given family. Yet there are some red flags when supposedly someone has to intervene and has to help. Here's Angel. He is 19. He's a cook at a restaurant.
first time I saw my dad do something in my eyes horrific was when I was, I believe, like between 6 and 8. My dad had went over to his friend Julian's house. Julian and my dad despised their neighbor. And as my dad's walking outside, the neighbor was outside. They got into an argument. My dad gets in. He tells me to put a seatbelt on. I put my seatbelt on. My dad turns the car on and runs him over. Backs up over him. It runs over him one more time. He looks over at me and says, "If you tell your mother, I'm gonna kill you." My dad was always selling either cocaine, crack cocaine, and marijuana, along with having his day job. Growing up through, from what I can remember of my adolescence, is my father coming in and out of the house with a nefarious amount of people that you wouldn't consider good people, drug dealers, people who offer protection to people for money. When they weren't there, my dad was usually extremely angry, and he would either beat me or my mother. Never really my sister, though. But eventually that changed once he started using the drugs himself. He was in the military for like actually a year or two, but through my adolescence kept up that facade and acted as like he wasn't doing anything that he was doing. He of course was saying that he doesn't want me to follow his path, and that is why he tried bringing me up the way he thought he would if he stuck with the military. Always cutting my hair short, making sure I was always home at certain times, enforcing not to who hang out with, what not to do. When he got out of the military, he was honorably discharged. So after that, he left. They gave him medication for an extended period of time, which was supposed to be for 2 weeks of morphine. But the doctor accidentally gave him 2 months of morphine. So by the time he was done with his prescriptions, he was hooked. That's pretty much when it all started going downhill. When he didn't have his pills, or if he didn't have what he constantly smoked, was crack. If he didn't have that, then he started taking stuff that belonged to us, pawning it, and then going to get the money so then he is able to buy more. Me and my dad have fought in multiple times, and they have usually end up in me and him severely injured. It pent up a lot of anger. I hated him for very many reasons, but it also in turn made me hate myself, because I figured I'm the offspring of that, so it got me to think that I'm no better than he is. I don't let anyone get close. I don't ever see family anymore, and I feel like solitude is probably the best thing for me. I've learned I can't trust anybody in life. When people say, "Oh, why do you hate life? Why do you try to kill yourself?" You don't understand. You haven't gone what I've gone through. By the time I was 17, he was already handing me, I think it was like a half pound of marijuana, telling me to start selling. And after a while, I started doing it, started selling marijuana, and I was making a substantial amount of money. I looked in my closet, saw the safe, saw the gun, saw the weed, saw the money, and I thought about it. I'm doing exactly what he is. I'm going down the same exact path. That was the day that I realized I'm not doing that anymore. I finished what I had to finish, paid off who I had to pay off, and then I was done. He was basically a cancer in my life, and I needed to cut it out. As soon as I turned 18, I got out of that house and started doing my thing for myself instead of living there and going through that every day. I can find a better life than what was given to me before. The saying that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree can't be that right. I mean, in some cases it has to be, that's very true. But that's only if you let it be true.
These are the stories from people that live in your neighborhood, that shop in grocery stores near you, pass you on the sidewalks, ride in cabs next to you. This is Open Conversation, and I'm Regina Ravazova.
Regina Revazova is a producer here in Phoenix.
In education news, for immigration officials, schools are considered sensitive zones. Just like churches and hospitals, agents can't step on campus to conduct enforcement activities without a pressing circumstance, and only with permission from the superintendent. Still, many families in Phoenix are reporting a lot of fear around sending their kids to school. The Phoenix Union High School District is hoping to ease at least some of those tensions. From KJZZ's Education Desk, Carrie Young reports.
It's early evening at South Mountain High School in Phoenix, and school leaders are dimming the lights in the auditorium for the night's presentation.
The agents might say, oh, just open a little bit. We just want to talk to you, right?
Karina Ruiz is with the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, one of several immigration advocacy groups taking the stage tonight, talking to parents about what their rights are if they encounter immigration officials.
So you have the right to remain silent. If you start answering questions, you're going to start giving up your Miranda rights.
While school officials posted flyers across the district, just a few dozen people showed up Tuesday night, filling up the first two rows of the auditorium.
We think that we had a low turnout because of the fear.
She says typically her group hosts these Know Your Rights forums in people's homes to reduce the fear of being raided. Ruiz says this was one of the first times they've partnered with an entire school district. This Tuesday was the first of three forums being held this week in Phoenix Union. She says she's hoping word will get out that these school resource fairs are safe to attend.
We're hoping that slowly but surely the crowd of people are going to start like coming back, losing that fear after they see that they're not going to be raided at one of these events.
There's been a lot of fear, which the community has expressed to us at every single board meeting for the past few months. And this tonight is about addressing some of those fears and providing people with resources so that they can feel more confident.
Stanford Prescott is a governing board member for the Phoenix Union High School District's second ward. He says that confidence is key because when students are consumed with thoughts that they could be picked up at school, they're not absorbing lessons well or focusing on homework.
I hope that students and their families get a sense of what resources are out there, that they have some of their questions answered, and that they're able to know that the Phoenix Union High School District is a safe space for every student, regardless of immigration status or anything else.
In addition to the talks happening on stage tonight, attendees were also given folders with legal documents, like G28 forms that attorneys need before representing someone, and worksheets to help families create a safety plan.
I've learned that everybody has a right. I have the right to tell the parents and children that don't be scared, but because they can do something and they can apply their rights.
Alisa, who gave us only her first name, is a parent in the district. She says she plans on sharing all of this information with her neighbors that didn't come.
And with all this information, I can support them more.
Back in the South Mountain High School auditorium, community advocate Karina Ruiz is wrapping up the evening with a skit.
¿Quién es? ¿Qué quieren?
Agente de inmigración, abre la puerta.
¿A quién buscan?
She says she's hoping the audience can come away with a few but important basic lessons so they can avoid situations like Manuel Montes says he recently faced. According to a USA Today report, Montes, who is believed to be the first immigrant with active DACA status or deferred action for childhood arrivals, deported under the Trump administration. He told the paper he signed a lot of papers he didn't understand and answered questions from immigration officials just hours before being deported.
And I was like, oh man, you should have come to one of the forums to learn that you don't have to.
Officials at Phoenix Union High School District say this week's forums are just the beginning. While school leaders say they'll follow federal law, they're hoping events like this will help the community feel more confident that the school really is a safe space. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally this week, in a look at business news. More and more police departments are using body cameras as they look for ways to protect themselves, their communities, and to preserve evidence. And the lucrative new body camera market is becoming fiercely competitive. One Valley tech company is giving away their hardware up front. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the real money is to be made on the back end.
For almost two decades, Taser International was known for making stun guns. But now there's a new product rolling off its production line in Scottsdale, Arizona, body cameras.
And we're doing about 500 a day. We can easily ramp that up.
Spokesman Steve Tuttle says the cameras have become such a focus for the company that it's rebranded, now calling itself Axon after its most popular camera model. Axon cameras are in use at police departments in 36 major U.S. cities. In a bid to assert its dominance on the market, Axon recently came out with an aggressive offer, a free body camera for every cop in America who wants to try one.
Now, that's a pretty big shot to be firing out there, and we're encouraging all our competition to do the exact same thing.
But one competitor isn't likely to follow suit.
Taser's offer is the Venus flytrap of the body-worn camera world.
Gray Hutkins is executive vice president of Safariland, which is the parent company of camera maker VView. His company has claimed in lawsuits that previous Axon giveaways violate the bidding process police departments use to look for suppliers.
You know, there's no such thing as free. Whenever somebody is doing an evaluation of a product, there's a whole back end to it that has implementation costs and makes it very difficult to switch out of once you're done.
VView says departments may be lured in by the free front-end equipment, but then become attached to the evidence storage system, and that's where the real money is. Axon's data storage can cost anywhere from $50 to $100 per officer per month, and police departments that buy an Axon camera have to use Axon software.
The other thing you got to think about is the length of the contract.
That's Michael White. He's a criminology professor at Arizona State University. He wrote a guide on the body camera procurement process for the Department of Justice.
So if you're going to do cloud-based storage, you'll do it for X number of years, and that's the negotiation piece. Then what's going to happen after that 3 or 5 years are up?
He says while most of the larger body camera companies contract with Microsoft Azure to store the data, agreeing to a proprietary software system can chain a department to a particular product.
Last I saw, there are more than 50 different companies to choose from, so it can be very, very overwhelming.
Commander Noah Johnson oversaw the Tempe Police Department's search for body cameras. They went with Axon because its evidence platform was easy for his officers to navigate.
Anybody can make a camera. The biggest piece for us is the back end, the data management.
At the end of their shifts, officers can plug the camera into a docking station and then access the videos from a smartphone or a computer.
It's a very simple thing, and it's got to be cop-friendly, right?
On top of the monthly data storage costs, Johnson had to reassign deputies to manage the body camera program. It's been a huge investment of dollars and labor, about $360,000 a year. But he says it's worth it.
You can't put a price on developing a better relationship with your community, right? You know, it's kind of like the commercial is priceless.
But there is a significant price on the data storage, and that's exactly what the body camera companies are banking on. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Frickie, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.